Howdy, everybody. Welcome to West Virginia Uncommonplace. Today, I have with me an astonishing guest. And the reason that I'm going to say this is because the topics that we're going to talk about today are going to be revolutionary. They're going to involve the 70s. They're going to involve San Francisco. They're going to involve research. They're going to involve someone's life. And the lady here with me today has an amazing name that I chopped up. I chopped it up in our pre-call. Her name is Leanna Wolf. Please tell us why you are here and a little bit about yourself, something that no one knows about you.
Oh, well. Well, first, thank you so much for inviting me. I had no idea that a podcast based in West Virginia would be interested in my story, but I'm so pleased that it is. And I, right now I live in Los Angeles, and I came of age in Palo Alto, California, before it was known as the home of Google and Facebook. Hewlett-Packard had just started rumbling in somebody's garage. And my dad worked in the precursor to Silicon Valley in what was then called Stanford Industrial Park. But I was a kid who was very curious, as well as a little bit shy. It was like I was okay performing, and I did children's theater as an actress, but I didn't exactly know how to figure out all the things I wanted to figure out. And as I became a teen, I was really curious, as all teens are, about sexual energy. And I'd see folks making out on park benches, and I'd like, what is that? And how come they're, and I was just, so much of it really intrigued me, but I had no idea how I'd access that energy and all the rest of it. And so my first efforts at trying to figure out about it were going to the library. You know, back in the day, there was no internet, and there really wasn't much sex education. My parents, you know, really tried. I mean, they told us about reproduction. But, and I remember once asking them, what's sex like? And they said, and I was 13, and I had done my first homemaking class dinner for my family, and I'd made an orange chiffon pie. And my dad said, it's at least as good as that pie.
So let me ask you this. In the 70s, the sexual revolution in the San Francisco Bay Area, how did that shape your perspective on human sexuality and influence your later on career path?
Well, basically, what I happened to me was the year I started having sex with my then boyfriend was 1973, which was the year that Roe versus Wade became the law of the land. And birth control was widely available. I could get it at the student health center, and there wasn't yet AIDS. So we had a time, even as young folks, where we were pretty free to explore. I mean, there weren't a lot of, and morality had shifted so that, you know, it didn't, you know, if you had done some experimenting or a lot of experimenting, you didn't get labeled necessarily as somebody who was a whore or whatever. It was just part of how life was. And pretty much every time I went to a party in my late teens and early and 20s, I'd meet someone and probably take them home. And that was just, I mean, that was just standard behavior. And in those days, it was called a one-night stand. And, you know, I always hoped the one-night stand might lead to more. But if it didn't, it wasn't a big problem, because the next weekend I'd meet someone else. And and there wasn't the, you know, the thing of dating apps and getting ghosted. And Me Too hadn't emerged. So there wasn't all this distancing between the genders where, you know, women were suspect of men, but we were all in community and exploring.
Okay. Now, your transition from academia to launching Wise Women Sex and Relationship Consulting, how does your background in sexual anthropology inform your counseling approach?
Oh, okay. Well, what happened was I'd been a professor for a very long time. I began teaching, probably in the early 80s, and taught for a good 37 years in all kinds of venues, colleges, universities, etc. And at some point, I started getting beat out by the cell phones. My students were so addicted to their phones that they could not pay attention to a lecture. And if I screened a film that was longer than 15 minutes, they'd all fall asleep because they were, primed for, short form reels and TikToks and whatever. And I was just really tired of trying to engage people that were only there for the credit and not for the adventure. And so I had gotten a doctorate in sexology in 2003, and I was then more and more integrating sexology into my anthropology curriculum and became what I called a sexual anthropologist. And then in 2016, I just said, I want to engage people who really want answers and really want reflection and really want discussion and come with appetite. Not And so I opened a counseling practice, and it was just what I wanted. I was getting folks who were curious about polyamory, who were exploring questions related to gender and identity, all the kinds of things I loved talking about, and I would basically curate the information to what they could handle hearing and put into practice in their own lives.
Okay, now, one thing in this show that we like to do, it's something that's classic and nostalgic to the show. We have this thing called a shameless plug, and with the shameless plug, you get to tell people where they can meet and greet you across the internet or whatever confines that you have set up for your personal communities. Would you please tell them real quick where they can meet and greet you?
Oh, well, I have a website called Wise Woman Sex and Relationship Consulting.com. And that's a good way to find out a lot more about me. My book just came out in January. And that's all over the internet. You could Google it and find it on Amazon, on many, many sites, as well as my publisher site, Roman and Littlefield. And that book is called 177 Lovers and Counting: My Life as a Sex Researcher. And if you happen to live in Los Angeles, I've developed a solo theater show in concert with my book, which takes about a tenth of the book and makes it into a comedic and informative and really fun hour-long show. And I'm going to be performing it in the Hollywood Fringe Festival in June. So there's 3 dates that I'll be performing it in Hollywood. So if you're here in LA, come track it down.
All right, and definitely, audience, inside our show notes, I'll definitely get back in touch with Miss Wolf about that. I'll put that information in our show notes. I'll get her to just send that over to me on that part. Now, we were just talking about this book. Now, let me tell you something that I did wrong with your book. When initially I seen the title of it, I live on Interstate 77. So I didn't see that one at first. Initially, when we read through things, so I was like, oh my gosh, this is what I thought. I thought it said I-77 Lovers. And I was like, did she find love on Interstate 77, which runs from the top of New York all the way down to Florida? And I was like, whoa. So then after I got your book reading, got getting into reading it, I noticed that it started off as a personal memoir to me, in my opinion, and then it shifted to something else. So can you discuss the process of revising your book and the decision to position your story through the lenses of anthropology, politics, history, and sexuality, I mean sexuology?
Sure. Well, yeah, it basically my book is a memoir, but being an anthropologist, my publisher suggested that we call it an autoethnography, which is a memoir through the lens of anthropology. So anthropologists not only live their lives, but they use their personal desires and appetites and curiosities to explore other cultures. And so I was basically using the lens of anthropology to explore sexuality, not just as I was coming of age, but as I began to do field work in different parts of the world. So
Okay.
I ended up doing field work initially in Mexico and then eventually in East Africa, studying traditional polygyny, one husband and multiple wives, and adding on Papua New Guinea, and then looking at the transition from arranged marriage to love marriage in India, and then a bunch of things tied in with sexual tourism.
Okay. Now, I want to get this topic because this was a question that one of, because what we do on the show is like, I have listeners that I tell about guests that are coming on that are part of our exclusive group. This was one question from Janice out of Toledo, Ohio. She wanted to know about polyamory and jealousy.
Polyamory.
Polyamory, yeah, and jealousy. Thank you for correcting me. What were some surprising findings or insights you encountered?
Okay. Well, so I have both studied polyamory through doing a doctoral dissertation on polyamory and jealousy, as well as studying traditional polygamy in the form of polygyny, husband and multiple wives, in Africa and New Guinea. So what I discovered about any and all of this is that typically, as humans, we fall in love with one person at a time. And this is called serial monogamy. And we get captivated by a new person. And if they are that captivating, we have elevated dopamine and norepinephrine, and it becomes kind of a really delicious bit of brain chemistry until it fades. And when it fades, either one evolves that relationship into a much more stable relationship that, one might live together, marry, start a family, start a business, whatever they might all do together. And then the brain chemistry is more about oxytocin and vasopressin. But what I was noting with polyamory is that folks really wanted to make it work at the level of not having a new relationship destroy their already in place relationships. And this is a really difficult thing to do. And the only reason people do it is because they subscribe to what I call the culture of polyamory, where polyamorous very much believe in a concept called compersion, which is an invented concept where they believe they should have positive regard for their partner gaining attention, happiness, and sexual connection with other lovers. Now, most mainstream folks would never want that. They'd never want to hear about it. They'd never want to see it. And they would hope it would never happen. And thus, most mainstream folks, if they engage in this, it's called cheating and they try to keep it a secret. So, what's really interesting in terms of my research is how much the folks I was surveying absolutely believe in compersion. And they believe in this concept that you have the experience of new relationship energy when you meet someone new, but you don't believe in it. You don't believe that this new person is any different than the same kind of partner you've had before. And you enjoy them for what it is. And if your partner is in the thick of it, you give them some space, but realize that eventually that brain chemistry is going to subside and that they're not going to find that new person an actual improvement. And so what polyamory enables is for people to have a very full brain in terms of brain chemistry. They both have this stability and constancy and all that delicious oxytocin of a home relationship, as well as the excitement of someone new. Now,
Ah.
many people go into couples therapy because they've lost the spark and they hope they can keep their ongoing relationship exciting. And one of the things the Masters and Johnson Institute tried to do was work with folks who were trying to do that. And so they offered this year-long program in reigniting the spark. And after a year, they followed up with folks, and only 15% felt that their relationship had improved.
Whoa,
So
that's staggering.
So the deal is if someone or people buy into polyamory, they could have the best of two worlds. They could have
Okay.
excitement, newness, and all that, the adventure of telling your story to someone new who's absolutely captivated by you, and vice versa, as well as maintaining their home and maintaining their family and maintaining all the things that give their life stability
Lynn, I
and
do got
living in integrity,
the
because most folks who cheat and access some bit of that are not in integrity, and they're at constant risk for being discovered and potentially losing everything.
And Leanne, I wanted to say thank you for that, because the crazy thing you did and all the dialogue that you put out there, you questions that I was about to ask you, answered most of my questions right there. So I want to tell you that that was an amazing thing. Now, there's a bit of the show that we pay homage to a news magazine called 2020. As a child, growing up in the late 80s, early 90s, 2020 would come on. John Stossel, he was a comic relief. Diane Sawyer was on there, and she was poignant with her interviews. Elizabeth Vargas was all around a great interviewer, but there was one lady in particular, the late great Barbara Walters, that she could make people personable. And sometimes her show, her part would start about 10 minutes to 11. The news station would let it run over to 11:05 if it was a good interview she was doing. If it wasn't some of the best work of her life, it cut off at 11 o'clock and we went on with our lives. So, Lena Wolf, right now, are you ready to be on the hot seat?
Of course, this is exciting. I loved 2020, and I
All right.
remember all of those hosts.
All right. So first, we're going to do our John Stossel question. Inside cultures and sexual partners, there are always these types of misconceptions that certain races, certain ethnicities are aggressive in manners. And we're not talking about the actual aspect of sexual intercourse, but we're just talking about the sexual prowess, how they attract and how they consume things. And 177 lovers and counting. As a book and as a sexual research, an anthropologist, you have probably traveled the gauntlet of ethnicities and nationalities, correct?
A lot of it was more study than personal engagement, but I certainly have been around a couple blocks.
Yes, ma'am. So the fun first question is what is your least favorite interaction? And with us doing this, it's the show's not PG or X-rated or rated R, but the context of the question that I'm asking is, what was your least favorite experience in everything you've done?
Well, I would say getting raped.
Oh, sorry to hear that.
That's basically a power thing, much more than a sexual thing. And also, a fair amount of it was how it was regarded by our society, which was that our society was full of rape myths, which contended that, you know, if a woman was dressed scantily, if she accepted offers from strangers, if she was unaccompanied, that was, she was bringing it on, rather than whatever happened to her was just wrong. So, you know, I am ever so grateful for the Me Too movement for making sexual assault something that became part of common conversation. And because when it happened to me, I sensed that I was better off not discussing it with anybody. And if I wanted a career as an anthropologist and a researcher and a professor and a writer, that was what I wanted. And I didn't want to be known as a rape victim. And so I basically kept it squirreled away. And it was only with the emergence of the Me Too movement and my decision to do research on sexual assault that I did come out as someone who had survived rape. And no one ever, you know, treated me like it was my fault.
Okay, and that's, and I thank you for that. And that's the gem in this episode. And that's one thing I do like about our culture now, our society, that we embrace these things. Because like you said, even coming up when I was in the late 80s, it was something that was very taboo. And then let me take it back. I didn't mean to say taboo. It was something that wasn't spoken about. And people treated it as a condition and went on. They conditioned people not to talk about it. And like you said, the emergence of that. And I thank you for sharing that, because I know that had to be very hard to share. And the other gem inside that is you sharing that helps other people. Even though we have all these communications out here in the world, someone hearing it from you, they will embrace it even more. So on to the next question. Now this is the now we're going to the Diane Sawyer question. Now, you know, her question to me, in all honesty, Diane Sawyer is the best out of all of them. I love Barbara Walters, Elizabeth Vargas and all that, but Diane Sawyer could ask you a question and she could get like multiple answers out of you. So in doing research and traveling the world and taking care of all of this information and keeping it collective stored inside your mind, inside your memories museum, because I always say people have a memories museum of everything that they do. How do you settle down after all of this energy? And when I say this energy, I'm not talking about like, when I talk about the sexual energy, you know exactly what I'm talking about, like the intimacy that you build up with doing all this. Like I'm not saying it's like a high or anything, but how do you control your emotions and your well-being after you're done with everything? And I'm not talking about the form of masturbation or anything like that. I'm just talking about like after you're done doing your job, because your job is an intense job. How do you come home and keep that cup halfway filled or fill that cup all the way up at the end of the day?
That's a fascinating question. And actually, this whole process of getting to talk about my research and my practice and my book has been super fulfilling, because it gives me a place to really make sense of all this in a coherent and engaging and good way. Because, you know, otherwise, you know, I don't meet anyone like me. And so I've lived a unique life, and some of my reviewers claimed an extraordinary life, and that's very cool. But I'm a bit alone in this, and I don't really find colleagues who have lived quite the way I have. You know, here and there I have, but largely folks date for relationship, for finding a life partner. And they don't date for data. And for some reason, I was interested in dating for data. And I was using the opportunity of like meeting someone, connecting with them, diving into their world as like this amazing opportunity that I access pieces of them that I wouldn't have had access to any other way.
Okay.
And it was really funny when I started coming to terms with this, because I found out about this woman who had done a TED talk about how to best position her online in personals ad to get the kind of partner she was looking for. And so she had written about, you know, analyzing, you know, that as a smart woman, it wasn't enough to just present as sapiosexual, but she ultimately had to show some skin and she had to look sexy. But then she also went on to assess, you know, who was really a match. And what ended up happening is she, with all her research on the folks she was meeting, was encountering, she only responded to one person because she had done her research really well from the comfort of her home screen and met him, married him, started a family with him, and I guess, you know, continued on in the, on the relationship escalator, where I found that that was like not my purpose. I did not, well, I'll give lip service to wanting to meet the one. I'm a bit cynical about that, but I so enjoy meeting people.
Okay. Huh. Now, the Elizabeth Vargas question, hers is always well-rounded, and I like her. Now, at some point throughout your illustrious career, which is illustrious because this is amazing. Like, I do have to tell you that, even if you don't feel sometimes that it is, but it is amazing. And you kind of touched on it, and I want to ask you, after all this research and case studies on people in the dating, was there ever one person that ended up becoming the one, or what happened along the way with all this research and case study stuff that you were doing?
Oh, well, definitely there have been ones. And, you know, I've had, you know, several people who have become very significant in my life. And, you know, so two of them I lived with for a good long time, and I remain in touch with them and I consider them family. One of them just lost his mother, who was nearly 99. And the moment he and I connected, he took me to meet his whole family. And she immediately treated me like her daughter-in-law and just made me feel so welcome and just part of all of them, despite that I was truly quite different from them. But it didn't matter. She just had an open heart and was very accepting and very inclusive. So yeah, I'm not alone. I have quite a few exes that are dear, dear people to me. And that's how it is. I have had probably no mean breakups. And so it's all for me about having basically an extended family of choice.
Okay, and I like that. Now, on to your Barbara Walters question. You have said a word that kind of struck me and probably would have struck Barbara, the word alone. Alone and loneliness are two traits that we have to deal with in any structure of any type of form of relationship you have with anyone. So throughout all these years, have you ever had to make that distinction that, because this is a statement I always hear from people, I'd rather be alone, but I don't want to feel loneliness. Does that statement ring true to you, or
what is your statement? Well, I learned a lot about that through the pandemic because of all the isolation. Because I was so used to just being with other people physically, you know, driving across town and going to some gathering, going to parties, whatever it was. And, you know, for so much time, we all had to learn to sit with ourselves. And, you know, I did the best to not be lonely over it, but it taught me something really important, that I could sustain myself without the physical company of others. And actually, it was during the pandemic that I finished my book, because I'd run through everything I could on Netflix. There was nothing more to watch that interested in me. And so I had to actually go to the depths of my hard drive, find this book that had been simmering, and grind through it and get it all written. And I am so thankful for the pandemic for causing me to be able to live with myself and create in my own space and not be so drawn to the stimulation of the company of others. And, you know, when I think about it, I do my best when I'm alone. That's when I really think deeply, when I really have this space to generate theory. And I am really, really rarely lonely. And the same time, as I was raised by folks who were in constant motion. And I'd visit my mom, and we did like 10 things in a day. And, you know, she'd say, oh, well, let's go here to the shopping center, and then let's go to this art exhibit, and then there's a concert later on today. And I just got used to living a life with a lot of variety and a lot of physicality. And I know that that's really important to me. And like every day, I either take an exercise class or go on a hike or something, because I need to stay in motion.
Okay, and I thank you for that. Now, audience, Leanna Wolf, you can find all our information inside our show notes, because that's a great part about being on a podcast and having a podcast. A podcast enlightens people on all the dialogue and the video that will be released later on, so they can see us and see how we interacted and things like that. But the show notes are a great part, because some people are very analytical and they have to have things in those notes. So real quick, I want to say thank you for coming on the show, Miss Wolf. It was an amazing time having you on here and having all this knowledge that's passed along to me and to the rest of the audience. And people, go pick up this amazing book, 177 Lovers and Counting, My Life as a Sexual Researcher. And with this, I want you all to do this one thing. People miss out on this one thing that you can do to help every author. Buy the book, most definitely. But go, if you live in the capital of your state, go there and request the book at the state level library that's there, so that every county inside that state, I mean, every county inside the state can receive that book. So this author can have her book immortalized in every library in your county. For example, in West Virginia, there's 55 counties, only 1.5 million people, but we have 112 libraries, which is wild. So doing that little bit and buying her book also, and just interacting with her, the engagement is what you need to do with this type of information. Engaging and learning and interacting are ways to brighten your sexuality questions, experiences, and just anything all around, and just to be well-rounded. So I encourage you all to definitely link up with Miss Wolf and enjoy her presence. So on that note, I'm JR, and she is Leanna Wolf, and we're signing off.
Thank you.
Thank you. That was amazing.